Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday the 10th of July. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. This week, as the financial slump hits, it's good to know that not all landlords are ruthless rack renters. We take a look at the accountancy tricks that keep bankrupt businesses afloat, but the downside is rents are kept artificially sky high right across the city. We talk to the ethical property company that sees all buildings as part of the community. We also talk to Robert Nicol from Bristol Against the Arms Trade about Bristol's arms firms. And we take our final trip, delayed from last week, with founder Alan Britton around the gardens of Warmley House and Kingswood Heritage Museum.
As well as the latest episode of the serial, Treasure Island, by Robert Louis Stevenson. Read by Malcolm Grieve, no less. And we go back 2,000 years to ask, how many brothers and sisters did Jesus have? You may be surprised to hear the answer after a bit of digging in the book of Matthew. We also have some poets. We have a poet of the week. And not forgetting, of course, Jeff Sparks will be coming up later on with a What's On Guide. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BTFM 93.2, also broadcast on Preston FM and also in St Albans on Radio Very Lamb. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, if you're in the Bristol area that is, just off Queen Square, and the details for that will be at the end of the show. As the financial slump hits, it's good to know that not all landlords are ruthless rack renters, upping the rent in good times but refusing to reduce rent in the bad times. The market is rigged against us. The trouble is that all empty buildings appear as an asset on the accounts of the company that owns them, as if they were fully rented out. But if all these owners had to really rent the place out rather than just use it as an investment, market forces would kick in and both property values and the rents would settle down to a much lower level. That would be good for small businesses and other tenants, but some companies that were inflating the value of their property on the company books would go bust. So now you know, many companies that own empty buildings are in fact bankrupt. One business that makes sure all its properties are rented out is the Ethical Property Company. It's my pleasure to introduce Janine Woodward of Ethical Property. Hello.
Hello.
Is that the sort of official name of the business? Have I got it right?
Yeah, the Ethical Property Company.
Okay, and what is your spread geographically?
The Ethical Property Company UK is nationwide, but we actually now, excitingly, have European arms as well.
Okay.
And we're looking to expand into Kenya.
Explain to me a little bit, just, you know, what do you mean by ethical property? What is unethical or can be unethical about property?
When the company was set up, the founding directors were both working with local charities and cooperatives, and they identified that a lot of landlords would not necessarily behave very sympathetically to charities, so often because charities couldn't afford very posh offices, they would end up in a very poor quality accommodation, which landlords wouldn't maintain very well. They would often get sort of ripped off in the contracts that they were asked to sign and in the costs that they were asked to pay towards. And they just saw this real dichotomy that these organisations were trying to save money to do good things, but then they had to put so much effort into sorting out these kind of very badly run and managed properties that essentially that time could be much better used directed at the work that they were trying to do.
Right.
So they sort of thought, right, well, if we bring these organisations together under one roof, if we act as their landlord, and if we make sure that the buildings are well run, well managed, are flexible so it can cope with the changing kind of requirements of charities, then all the charities will have to worry about is paying us one payment for their property and they can get on with doing what they need to do and what
charity.
They want to do. Precisely.
Okay. So how long ago did that start?
About 10 years. I think the company was formed in 98 or 99, but the founding directors, one of whom is a Bristolian, have been doing it, they've been doing it off their own backs since the mid-80s. Most of our property is actually office space as opposed to shop space.
Okay.
So often you won't necessarily notice our buildings unless you know that it's an ethical property building.
Okay. What have you found the economy to be like in terms of how your business has been doing? Because obviously a lot of charities have been really struggling.
Yeah, unfortunately they are, which is really sad. And obviously that's going to affect us because some charities are unfortunately having to wind up because they've lost all their grant funding. But what we hope that we're able to do to help in these situations as a company is to be really flexible and sympathetic as a landlord. So what we're trying to do is find ways that if organisations are struggling with money and maybe need to shrink down in size, we can allow them to shrink down rather than say, well, no, you have to pay the rent on your space and that's that.
Yeah.
Kind of find ways to work with them to enable them to reduce their costs and then stay sustainable and survive as organisations.
What do you recommend, say, if a charity is like, well, I'm tied into this contract, like I can't really do anything about it. Do you offer advice to people as well as being a landlord?
We don't, but our sister charity does. Okay. So we have a sister charity called the Ethical Property Foundation, of which there's a regional office in Bristol as well. And they provide advice to charities on all aspects of their property needs. So you can always look up www.ethicalproperty.org.uk and you'll find the charity and you can get lots of advice from them.
Tell me a little bit about ethical business. I mean, it sounds like sort of a minority thing. How are you expanding?
We're expanding really rapidly as just ethical property. When I started, it was three of us in an office in Oxford running five or six buildings across the country. There's now over 40 staff, over 15 buildings that we own, plus three more that we manage on behalf of other landlords. And we're looking to take on other property as well. And we've expanded into Europe and we've proved ourselves financially successful year on year on year. In addition to just us, ethical business is actually a really expanding sector. The public and consumers in terms of retail business are much more aware, or want to be much more aware of the things that they're buying and where they're coming from and making sure that they're sourced ethically. So that's helping. And also there's a real kind of burst of activity in social enterprise, which we're seeing a lot of in Bristol, actually.
Okay. I mean, I noticed with a lot of people who are interested in ethical things that the word community comes up a lot.
I think community really gives people a base and really grounds them. And I think it's incredibly important. And what ethical property really want to do is use property to the benefit of the communities in which that property is located. So, for example, we manage Green Park Station in Bath, and that is a real multi-use site. It's got local businesses on it. It's got a square which can be used for local art and music events. It's got a market so we can support the growth of local traders. And we really want to use that so that the community see it as a base for kind of all of their activity, which supports them and helps to give them their identity.
Okay. Have you helped community here in Bristol?
Hopefully in lots of ways.
Yeah.
We have several buildings which house lots of local charities and businesses, some on Colston Street. So Blaze, the ceramics co-op, which you'll find on Colston Street, that's housed in one of our buildings.
Yeah.
And we've also got lots of organisations that we house in Brunswick Court on Brunswick Square, such as the Bristol Drugs Project and The Big Issue, all providing local services to the people of Bristol.
Okay.
And we also manage several community spaces which communities can hire out if they're running events or courses. So spaces like the Unitarian Chapel on Brunswick Square or St Michael's Parish Hall on Colston Street, which can be hired out at relatively low cost to local organisations so they can host community events.
Okay, how could people find out about that?
They can take a look on our website,
yeah,
which is www.ethicalproperty.co.uk.
Okay, what do you make of Hamilton House and the rapid success it's had over the last couple of years?
I think Hamilton House is great. I know kind of the people who run Coexist and we talk kind of quite a lot. And I think the way that they are trying to create a really sustainable community, which runs itself in many ways, is a really effective way to utilise buildings for the benefit of the community that it sits within.
So how do you operate? Do you have shareholders like a normal company?
Yeah, we're a profit-making company. So people can buy shares in us, invest in the company, and then we use that capital to purchase the buildings, which we then renovate to very high environmental standards and let out. So we are a real example of a successful ethical investment.
Is it maybe not, I don't know, a little bit oxymoronic? I mean, you're in it to make money, make a profit, but you also say you're ethical at the same time.
It's true we're in it to make a profit, but we're in it to make a triple profit, that of making financial returns for our shareholders, but also social returns through the way that we treat the tenants that we have and through the aims and objective of the tenants that we have, and environmental returns through the way that we're running our buildings. And we always try and balance those three returns really, really carefully. And we don't think that our company model works if you make one of those more important than the other.
Okay.
So yes, we make financial returns, but not at the peril of the other two.
How do you appraise if you're sort of being socially successful in your aims?
we have an annual report. And in that annual report, we have a social and environmental section. And every year we ask our tenants what they think about the ethical property company, our aims and our values, and whether we're performing to the values that they think we should hold.
For people who might want to rent a space, you know, local community organisations, what was your website once again if people want to?
www.ethicalproperty.co.uk.
Okay, brilliant. Well, Janine Woodward, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
If you are a charity or ethical business looking for advice or office space, a reminder that you can find Janine and the company on the internet. The address is www.ethicalproperty.co.uk.
Joining me in the studio is Bob Nichols from Bristol Against the Arms Trade. Welcome, Bob.
Hello.
We've had you on before and everyone enjoyed hearing you talk so much. We got you on again.
Thank you very much.
And today you're going to be talking to us about the kind of idea of never-ending war.
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Can I set the context and talk about global military spending is $1.6 trillion. Now, that's just a fantastic sum of money, but 10% of that sum of money would actually get you a wholesale improvement in global sanitation for everybody in the world. It would provide, this is again 10%, primary education for all the children in the world, eradicate world hunger, give clean drinking water for everybody, have a good chance at stopping the spread of AIDS, and have global environmental sustainability. So of your 10% of that money spent on military expenditure would sort out all those bills, which then, why is this mad? I call it a madness. Why are we spending all this money on military expenditure?
That's my question to you, Bob, really. Why?
Okay, right. Thank you. I read a book and it was a very powerful read and certainly got me more interested in campaigning or putting a lot of effort into this issue. And it was a book by Naomi Klein, who's a very knowledgeable American woman. And she wrote this book called Shock Doctrine. She wrote No Logo as well. And one of the themes is it's a sort of never-ending war. Now, to cut it short, what happened at 9/11... is that the American administration got permission, or they took advantage of the shock that happened around the world, especially in the American populace, to do things they wouldn't do otherwise. And from then on, they started a military expenditure and increased it vastly. What happens usually, the usual understanding around wars is they're used to get territory or get resources or take over countries. And what happened in about 2003 was a group of leading economists met, and they produced is a sort of Davos report, they called it. And what they found was that actually the sort of economies of those countries that were participating in this sort of war with Iraq and around the world was booming. Now, this didn't meet this thing where military expenditure was taking resources from the rest of the economy. And then so prior to 9/11, this concept would have a peace dividend. When you stopped having a war, you'd have resources and money to spend on other things in your economy. After then, that happened, and we've got this stage where it's like a snowball in a way. More and more money is going into military expenditure. The actual wars themselves create economic growth, basically. So and it's quite depressing because actually, so what happens is we have the leaders around the world, especially across America, once they sort one war out, they've got another one in the offing, and that will go on and on. Hence, you have things like these threats to the axis of evil. If once Iraq, you know, has been resolved in one way or another, then it goes to Afghanistan or North Korea or Libya.
So actually, war is positively encouraged to kind of prop up the economies of, for example, the US?
Well, there's such an overlap in the Americans spend a vast amount on military expenditure, and there's an overlap between the politicians and the corporations, the heads of the corporations themselves, and the military themselves. They're all, in a way, they're very interlinked and overlapped and intermeshed. So there is like a movement of self-interest. The politicians make the decisions that actually benefit all these corporations.
A great example, I suppose, being David Cameron, when he visited Egypt, taking the representatives from BAE Systems on a big trade envoy along with him, which kind of most people thought was actually in kind of very bad taste, but in order to sell weapons, because he claims these countries can buy them for their own protection, but, you know, Colonel Gaddafi is using British arms to concurrently at the same time that he was in Egypt to slaughter his own people. So, I mean, that's a great example of the politicians and the arms trade being in it together, I suppose.
Yeah, as I mentioned, there's no sort of ethics in the arms trade, really. Just prior to the war, Cameron was going on a sort of trade mission, and the Conservative Party has been very open about it. This is, we want exports by selling arms around the world.
In terms of the privatisation of war then, what's your opinion on the future? Is this just going to be, as you say, a snowball where there's always going to be a conflict one after the other, or kind of how is this going to engender itself later on?
Well, Naomi Klein, her book is actually quite optimistic because she actually was looking what was happening in South America when it's gone through a full cycle and the politics have changed there and people have taken control of their lives again. They've got more socially aware politicians. I mean, that would have to happen here, but it'd be a mass change of mass consciousness in a way for people to sort of wake up and say, no, we don't want to be spending money on arms. We could actually, if we chose to, spend money and solve so many world problems.
Great. Well, let's hope they do. I have to ask you about Filton and the MOD procurement base there, and just wondering if Bristol Against the Armed Trade kind of had any more information about what was going on there. It's a very kind of shady establishment, and I think people kind of would like to know more.
Well, in some respects, the arms companies are very proud of what they do, and their strategy is distance themselves from the suffering they cause. So they're very open and they're very, very proud of these very high-tech machines that kill people, you know, like the drones or the missiles. But they don't really want you to see that suffering. There's two main aspects of the arms industry in Bristol is the aerospace. So there are other arms companies, and BA Systems are one of them, making parts of planes. And there's one company, MBDA, who just solely make missiles, and they make the ones that go on the drones, and we use them on our Typhoon planes and Tornado planes as well, and they fire them off ships, and they're large and small missiles. One big aspect of what happens in Bristol, we've got MOD procurement, is actually where the Ministry of Defence buys weapons, and there's, again, this big overlap between the industry of providing the weapons and obviously the usual buyer for weapons is the government, so our government. So we have a lot of arms companies in Bristol, and there's a lot of design development goes on with the aircraft carriers and things like that.
So actually it's very close to home, this whole...
It is, yeah, the whole thing about production and the sort of politics, really, yes.
Brilliant. If people want to find out more about Bristol Against the Arms Trade, have you got a website they could go to find out more information?
Yeah, it's quite simple, bristolagainstarmstrade.wordpress.com.
Brilliant. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, thank you.
Apologies to those listening out last week for the third and final part of our tour of Kingswood Heritage Museum, which we're off to now. Just outside the Ring Road on the eastern fringes of Bristol is one of the city's best-kept secrets. William Champion was forced by the City Fathers to leave the centre for Kingswood because of the noise and pollution made by his pioneering brass works, which were at the cutting edge of the Industrial Revolution. Run by volunteers and open every Tuesday and Sunday, Kingswood Heritage Museum costs £2 to get in and gets virtually no support from the government, despite preserving some of the region's most important history. Alan Britton is one of the founding members of the Kingswood Heritage Museum Trust, and he took Dialect's Tony Gosling on a tour of the grounds of Warmley House and William Champion's famous Sink Foundry, the first of its kind, which housed the world's biggest steam engine. We rejoin them by the Echo Lake opposite the Statue of Neptune.
This is a Statue of Neptune, said to be the largest Statue of Neptune in the country, built of concrete and slag, and around the back of it is like a cloak, wave-shaped around the back, built of the cinders from the factory. Originally, he would have had a left arm going across his chest. You can see the metal supports. The head is not the original, but it is a fantastic statue to have here. It was purchased by National Smelting and given to the then Kingswood Council, as part of Avon at the time. The head has been remoulded. We've been told that it was, in fact, a local doctor who did it. Got fed up with there being no face on there, and he put up a ladder and actually did it. Originally, in his right hand, which supporting his trident. And so the trident would have been about 30 feet long, just above his head. And we were told that it was made of copper. He would have stood, actually, in the lake. The lake would have been just lapping up to his feet pretty well, and then going on beyond him, where all these trees are, and across there, the other side of that fence. So this is 13 acres of lake. A pleasure lake, but also a reservoir for the factory, because the factory, of course, was relying on intermittent power sources. They had the windmill, they had water wheels, they had horse-driven mills and so on, but very difficult to keep it going, and so they would need a reservoir to do it.
Now, there isn't really much in the way of rivers around here now, is there?
Just over that fence there is Warmley Brook, which has always been there, and the brook would have flowed through this lake. But there's not all that much water in there, and there wouldn't have been all that much water at the time, so they're always short of water. As indeed they were in Coalbrookdale, short of water there as well.
So why the demise of the factory then?
William Champion, who lived here from the mid-1740s until the late 1760s, he had the monopoly, basically, of producing zinc, and zinc is necessary for producing brass. It's an alloy of copper and zinc. Zinc was imported from China and India. They were very early, centuries before, they were producing zinc in small quantities. And so, although they were all Quakers, they were nevertheless businessmen and in competition. And so they tried to undercut him by buying their zinc from India and importing their zinc and so on, tried to cut off his coal supply and so on. And also, here we have an integrated works. The raw materials come in, the coal comes in, and the finished product goes out. Brass pans, brass pins, they produced enough wire to produce something like 10 million pins a week. Pins used a lot in those days, in the 18th century. And so this was an integrated site. But he then became ambitious, developed other sites at New Cheltenham, at Kelston and at Bitton. There's a similar site at Bitton, or the remains of one. And once you start splitting up, you have transport problems. Like transporting coal by cart, 10 miles, you would double the price of coal. It's sort of that expensive to do it. And so he then overstretched himself. And there is a story that he realised he was going bankrupt in the 1760s and started surreptitiously withdrawing his money from the company. And so the Quakers kicked him out of their society. And so he was forced into bankruptcy, and his rivals, the Bristol Brass Company, bought him out.
So what is zinc actually used for?
Well, it is an element. It is just an element itself. A molecule itself is zinc.
So is it actually sort of melted down like iron or whatever from a kind of zinc oxide stone or whatever? How do they make it?
It has to be reduced using carbon in the form of coke or charcoal, and it has to be in a sealed crucible. You don't want air to get back to it. It comes off as a gas. The zinc boils at 907 Celsius, which is quite a low temperature for it to boil, and the temperature of the furnace would be up over 1,000, so it would come off as a gas. And so you didn't want the gas to come in contact with the air, because it would simply burn back to the oxide again. So it was in fact distilled down a tube into water. This was how it's made, and then it's melted, mixed with copper, to make brass.
And what was the real advantage of brass then as a byproduct?
Brass is a wonderful material for making things with, for doing engineering. At the time, clocks, things like this, were clockwork mechanisms were being developed. You know, the cogs for a clock, they're made out of brass. They still are made out of brass. And to get good quality brass, you need a high amount of zinc in it. You can smelt zinc oxides, zinc ores, and copper ores together, and you get brass. But it's not good quality brass. You need more zinc, so you need to add zinc to it or mix the two together. You need somewhere like 40% of zinc in it to get good quality for engineering.
So you can't really have an industrial revolution without it, really?
No, the later industrial revolution needed zinc. And, of course, very early on they were using it for zinc plating, galvanising and various other things. Galvanising, you dip iron into molten zinc, and it comes out with a layer of zinc on it, and this protects it. The corrugated iron used today, even today, has a layer of zinc on it, and it works by preferential oxidation of the zinc. So if you scratch your corrugated iron, it won't rust because it's surrounded by zinc still. All you get is just a little rust line. You won't get a great big hole, not until most of the zinc is gone. So it goes preferentially. Once the zinc is oxidised away, then the steel will rust. But it will last about 50 years or more.
So if you're coming up to visit here, you're getting a bit of history.
Oh, fantastic history as far as metallurgy goes. Tremendous on this site. We've got social and industrial history here in Kingswood.
Founder member of Kingswood Heritage Museum Trust, Alan Britton there, on the final part of our tour around Warmley House, Public Gardens with Dialect's Tony Gosling. The museum is open every Tuesday and Sunday through the summer and autumn. You'll find it on Tower Lane in Warmley. William Champion's historic Wimble Tower gives the lane its name. If you can volunteer once a week or once a month to help keep the museum open, that would be much appreciated. And you can explore the gardens and grottos on a £2 guided walk every second Sunday in the month, starting from the museum at 2:15. Bring a torch and wander as you wander through the grottos, which will be specially opened for you by your guide. If you're going by car, you want the Deanery Road roundabout off the Ring Road between the Hannam and Kingswood exits. By bus, aim for Cadbury Heath, and two buses stop right outside the museum. They are the 43 and the 319. It's open Tuesday and Sunday from 9:30 to 4:30, and the telephone number is 0117 960 5664.
Treasure Island is an adventure novel, you may know this, by Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson. There are a number of inns which claim to have been the inspiration for places in the book. In Bristol, the Landdog of Trow is claimed to be inspiration for the Admiral Benbow. But in Penzance, Cornwall, there is a 17th century inn named Admiral Benbow, which has arguably an even better claim. Many believe Bristol's Hole in the Wall may be Stephen's model for his Spyglass Tavern. Malcolm Grieve reads this week's episode of Treasure Island.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 2, The Sea Cook. Chapter 11, What I Heard in the Apple Barrel.
No, not I, said Silver. Flint was captain. I was quartermaster, along of my timber leg. The same broadside I lost my leg, old Pugh lost his deadlights. It was a master surgeon him that amputated me, out of college and all. Latin by the bucket and whatnot. But he was hanged like a dog and sun-dried like the rest at Corso Castle. That was Roberts's men, that was, and come to changing names to their ships, Royal Fortune and so on. Now what a ship was christened, so let her stay, I says. So it was with the Cassandra, as brought us all safe home from Malabar, after England took the Viceroy of the Indies. So it was with the old Walrus, Flint's old ship, as I've seen her muck with the red blood and fit to sink with gold. Ah, cried another voice, that of the youngest hand on board and evidently full of admiration. He was the flower of the flock, was Flint. Davis was a man too, by all accounts, said Silver. I never sailed along of him. First with England, then with Flint. That's my story. I'm now here on my own account, in a manner of speaking. I laid by 900 safe from England and 2,000 after Flint. That ain't bad for a man before the mast. All safe in bank. Tain't earning now. It's saving, does it? You may lay to that. Where's all England's men now? I dunno. Where's Flint's? Why, most of 'em aboard here. I'm glad to get the duff. Been begging before that, some on 'em. Old Pugh, as had lost his sight. Old Pugh, as had lost his sight and might have thought shame, spends £1,200 in a year, like a lord in Parliament. Where is he now? Well, he's dead now and under hatches. But for 2 year before that, shiver my timbers, the man was starving. He begged, and he stole, and he cut throats, and starved at that by the powers. Well, it ain't much use after all, said the young seaman, "'Tain't much use for fools you may lay to it. "'That nor nothing,' cried Silver. "'But now, you look here. "'You're young, you are, but you're as smart as paint. "'I see that when I set my eyes on you, "'and I'll talk to you like a man.' "'You may imagine how I felt "'when I heard this abominable old rogue addressing another "'in the very same words of flattery "'as he had used to myself. "'I think if I had been able "'that I would have killed him through the barrel.' Meantime he ran on, little supposing he was overheard. "'Here it is about gentlemen of fortune. "'They lives rough, and they risk swinging. "'But they eat and drink like fighting cocks, "'and when a cruise is done, why, it's hundreds of pounds "'instead of hundreds of farthings in their pockets. "'Now, the most goes for rum and a good fling, "'and to sea again in their shirts. "'But that's not the course I lay. "'I puts it all away, "'Some here, some there, and none too much anywheres by reason of suspicion. "'I'm 50, mark you. "'Once back from this cruise, I set up gentleman in earnest. "'Time enough too, says you. "'Ah, but I've lived easy in the meantime. "'Never denied myself a nothing heart desires "'and slept soft and nate dainty all my days, but when at sea. "'And how did I begin? "'Before the mast, like you.'
"'Well,' said the other,
"'but all the other money's gone now, ain't it? "'You don't show your face in Bristol after this.' "'Why, where might you suppose it was?' asked Silver derisively. "'Bristol in banks and places,' answered his companion. "'It were,' said the cook. "'It were when we weighed anchor. "'But my old missus has it all by now. "'And the spyglass is sold, lease and goodwill and rigging. "'And the old girl's off to meet me.' I would tell you where, for I trust you, but it'd make jealousy among the mates.
"'And can you trust your missus?' asked the other.
"'Gentlemen of fortune,' returned the cook, "'usually trust little among themselves, and right they are, you may lay to it. "'But I have a way with me, I have. "'When a mate brings a slip on his cable, one as knows me, I mean, "'it won't be in the same world with old John.' There was some that was feared of Pew, and some that was feared of Flint. But Flint his own self was feared of me. Feared he was, and proud. They was the roughest crew afloat was Flint's. The devil himself would have been feared to go to sea with them. Well now, I tell you, I'm not a boasting man, and you've seen yourself how easy I keep company. But when I was quartermaster, lambs wasn't the word for Flint's old buccaneers. Ha! You may be sure of yourself, in old John's ship.
"'Well, I tell you now,' replied the lad. "'I didn't half a quarter like the job till I had this talk with you, John.
"'But here's my hand on it now. "'And a brave lad you were, and smart too,' answered Silver, "'shaking hands so heartily that all the barrel shook. "'And a finer figurehead for a gentleman of fortune I never clapped my eyes on.'
By this time I had begun to understand the meaning of their terms. By a gentleman of fortune, they plainly meant neither more nor less than a common pirate. And the little scene I had overheard was the last act in the corruption of one of the honest hands, perhaps of the last one left aboard. But on this point I was soon to be relieved, for Silver giving a little whistle, a third man strolled up and sat down by the party.
"'Dick Square,' said Silver. "'Oh, I'd know Dick was Square,'
returned the voice of the coxswain, Israel Hands.
"'He's no fool, is Dick.'
And he turned his quid and spat.
"'But look here,'
he went on.
"'Here's what I want to know, Barbecue. "'How long are we a-going to stand off and on like a blessed bumboat?' I've had almost enough for Captain Smollett. He's hazed me long enough, by thunder. I want to go into that cabin, I do. I want their pickles and wines and that.
Israel, said Silver, your head ain't much account nor never was. But you're able to hear, I reckon. Leastways, your ears is big enough. Now, here's what I say. You'll berth forward... And you'll live hard, and you'll speak soft, and you'll keep sober,
till I give the word. And you may lay to that, my son. Well, I don't say no, do I? Growled the coxswain. What I say is, when? That's what I say. When, by the powers, cried Silver. Well now, if you want to know, I'll tell you when. The last moment I can manage, and that's when. Here is a first-rate seaman, Captain Smollett, sails the blessed ship for us. Here's his squire and doctor with a map and such. I don't know where it is, do I? No more do you, says you. Well then, I mean this squire and doctor shall find the stuff and help us to get it aboard by the powers. Then we'll see. If I was sure of you all, sons of double Dutchmen, I'd have Captain Smollett navigate us halfway back again before I struck. Why, we're all seamen aboard here, I should think, said the lad Dick. We're all foxhole hands, you mean, snapped Silver. We can steer a course, but who's to set one? That's what all you gentlemen split on, first and last. If I had my way, I'd have Captain Smollett work us back into the trades at least. Then we'd have no blessed miscalculations and a spoonful of water a day. But I know the sort you are. I'll finish with them at the island as soon as the blunt's on board. And a pity it is. But you're never happy till you're drunk. Split my sides, I've a sick heart to sail with the likes of you. Easy, old Long John, cried Israel. Who's a crossing of you? Why, how many tall ships, think you now, have I seen laid aboard? And how many brisk lads drying in the sun at execution dock? Cried Silver. And all for this same hurry and hurry and hurry. You hear me? I've seen a thing or two at sea, I have. If you would only lay your course and a point to windward, you would ride in carriages, you would. But not you. I know you. You'll have your mouthful of rum tomorrow. And go hang. Everybody knowed you was a kind of chaplain, John. But there's others as could hand and steer as well as you, said Israel. They liked a bit of fun, they did. They wasn't so high and dry nohow, but took their fling, like jolly companions, every one. So, says Silver, well, and where are they now? Pew was that sort. And he died a beggar man. Flint was, and he died of rum at Savannah. Ha! They was a sweet crew, they was. Only, where are they? But, asked Dick, when we do lay him athwart, what are we to do with him anyhow? There's the man for me, cried the cook admiringly. That's what I call business. Well, what would you think? Put him ashore like maroons? That would have been England's way. Or cut him down like so much pork. That would have been Flint's, or Billy Bones. Billy was the man for that, said Israel. Dead men don't bite, says he. Well, he's dead now hisself. He knows the long and the short of it now. And if ever a rough hand came to port, it was Billy. Right you are, said Silver. Rough and ready. But mark you here. I'm an easy man. I'm quite the gentleman, says you. But this time it's serious. Duty is duty, mates. I give my vote. Death. When I'm in Parliament and riding in my coach, I don't want none of these sea lawyers in the cabin a-coming home unlooked for, like the devil at prayers. Wait, is what I say. But when the time comes, why, let her rip. John, cries the coxswain, you're a man. You'll say so, Israel, when you see, said Silver. Only one thing I claim. I claim Trelawney. I'll wring his calf's head off his body with these hands. Dick, he added, breaking off, you just jump up like a sweet lad and get me an apple to wet my pipe like. You may fancy the terror I was in. I should have leapt out and run for it if I had found the strength, but my limbs and heart alike misgave me. I heard Dick begin to rise,
and then someone seemingly stopped him, and the voice of Hans exclaimed, "Oh, stow that! Don't you go sucking of that bilge, John! Let's have a go of the rum."
"Dick," said Silver,
"I trust you. I've a gauge on the keg, mind. There's the key. You'll find a pannikin and bring it up."
Terrified as I was, I could not help thinking to myself that this must have been how Mr. Arrow got the strong waters that destroyed him. Dick was gone but a little while, and during his absence Israel spoke straight on in the cook's ear. It was but a word or two I could catch, and yet I gathered some important news, for, besides other scraps that tended to the same purpose, this whole clause was audible: "Not another man of them will join." Hence, there were still faithful men aboard. When Dick returned, one after another of the trio took the pannikin and drank, one to luck, another with "Here's to old Flint," and Silver himself sang in a kind of song, "Here's to ourselves, and hold your luff, plenty of prizes and plenty of duff." Just then a sort of brightness fell upon me in the barrel, and looking up I found the moon had risen and was silvering the mizzen top and shining white on the luff of the foresail. And almost at the same time the voice of the lookout shouted, "Land ho!"
That was the 11th episode of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, read wonderfully for us by Malcolm Grieve.
Barry Smith died in June 2002. He was a preacher and author from New Zealand who travelled extensively, preaching throughout the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand and the United Kingdom, as well as elsewhere. He wrote 8 books about the Book of Revelation. Barry was strongly anti-Masonic, believing that Freemasonry to be a religious cult. He often talked about the detail of the Great Seal on the US $1 bill, linking the symbolism to Freemasonry, and the map layout of landmark buildings in Washington, D.C., in which can be found the Masonic Square and Compass and the inverted pentagram. But one thing he is less well known for is his flair for picking facts out of the Bible which hundreds of years of scholars appear to have missed, such as how many children Mary had.
She had at least 6 other children beside Jesus. Mary had 6 other children besides Jesus. You say, what? Is that in the Bible? Yes. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 13, please. Most Christians I've spoken to don't know this. No one's ever told them. Is there anybody here tonight comes from a small town or a village? And you will agree with me that when something exciting happens in your village, everybody goes to have a look at it. If there's a fire down the road, does everybody follow the fire engine? If Mr. Brown is bashing up Mrs. Brown, does everybody go to have a look? Yes. How much more did the people know all the details of what went on when Jesus and Mary and Joseph lived in town? Let's see what they said. Let's read together in Matthew 13, verse 55. "Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And his brethren are called James." Next one. "Joseph." Next one. "Simon." Next one. "Judas." She had at least 6 other children besides Jesus, and here are the names of 4 of them. You said there's supposed to be 6, but I've only mentioned 4 here. I know, but we haven't finished reading yet. We're now going to read verse 56. Here we go. "And his sisters," plural, "are they not all with us?" And so we see that not only did Mary have 4 boys, she had more than one girl. Do we know the names of the girls? We know the name of one. So we turn to the book of Mark, chapter 15. Let's turn to Mark 15 tonight, shall we? If I can read it, everybody can read it. Read with me, please. Here's Jesus hanging on the cross. And you'll see there in verse 40 altogether. This is Mark 15 and verse 40. "There were also women looking on afar off, among whom was Mary Magdalene," look at it, "and Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joseph," those two are mentioned, "and Salome." So the name of one of Jesus' half-sisters was Salome. We don't know the name of the other one. So that means that the Lord Jesus Christ was brought up in a very large family. I find that exciting. But he was brought up in a big family. I can imagine from time to time he worked with his father in the carpenter shop. Can you imagine Joseph saying, "Sweep under the bench there"? He didn't call him Jesus. His name was Yeshua. That's his Hebrew name. His Hebrew name was Yeshua, and that means Savior. And if you put a long A above it, Yeshua, it means salvation. So when Mary called them for dinner at night, she would call out, "Yeshua, James, Joseph, Simon, Judas, Salome, bring your young sister and come in for dinner."
Preacher Barry Smith there, whose favourite song was Amazing Grace, with which he ended his meetings, and in his eyes, his greatest success was not in forecasting future events, but in leading large numbers of people to Jesus. At the end of World War II, Hitler's right-hand man throughout the war, Martin Bormann, disappeared. Hitler was reputed to have formally handed the Nazi leadership to him as the Russian army closed in on his Berlin bunker. In 1947, US newspaper reports told of the discovery of Bormann's remains in the ruins of Berlin. But Ladislas Ferrago and others discovered that these US reports had been fakes. Hitler's henchman, Martin Bormann, was living out his retirement happily in South America. He's believed to have died in the early 1970s, and it is quite a job to discover how he was spirited away along the so-called Nazi rat lines. US author Carter Heydrich takes up the story, and John's going to read that for us now.
In May 1945, a huge Nazi U-boat destined for Japan surrendered at sea to US Navy forces. Three times the size of the average U-boat, the submarine was stuffed full of enriched uranium and other atomic bomb components, as well as the plans and parts to build jet fighters, previously unheard of, and Germany's feared V-2 rocket. The atomic bomb components were then transferred to the Manhattan Project to complete the second atomic bomb, which was ultimately dropped on Nagasaki. Perhaps most intriguing, the U-boat surrender appears to have been pre-arranged between American military, intelligence and political leaders and Hitler's top lieutenant, Martin Bormann, in exchange for Bormann's escape and post-war freedom. My book, Critical Mass, questions the foundations of the traditional history of the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project with provocative new evidence drawn from historical documents within US National Archives, German Archives and from personal accounts. The new evidence, contrary to the traditional history that insists the US developed the bomb with help from England, shows that the secretly surrendered nuclear and other components from Nazi Germany's atomic bomb project were used in the Manhattan Project. The surrendered nuclear materials, at one time destined from Germany to its ally Japan, were ultimately used against the island nation by the United States to usher in the nuclear age.
And Carter Heydrich's book tracing what happened to Hitler's right-hand man Martin Bormann and the Nazi weapons-grade heavy metals is called Critical Mass.
Now time for some poetry from Tim Burrows. This is a poetry soundscape that he created, and this is called Nureyev.
Nureyev, blonde-haired son of Ufa, legend of ballet's art, piercing blue eyes, falling lock of hair, covers your look of daring. Soaring through the air, limbs practiced to perfection, pounded and stretched, fit to fly to the sky, to be named a star in the heavens. Mouth full of oaths, the earth balancing out the sky, yin to yang, fire to water, snow and ice on the steppe, hiding the passion inside. Divided from family for freedom, too wild and unbridled for party bureaucrats, having to dance incessantly to smother the pain of separation, your father never saw you dance. Arms to catch a flying Fontaine, a legendary duo too big for history, too special for the tat of tabloids. Standing ovations at every show, her cool elegance matched your fire. Finally allowed to visit your mother, few hours to fill the loneliness of years, desperate that she recognised you through the blurred mirror of your tears. You lived your life fully, with lovers dance and pain, striving for perfection, working through the pain. Yet always whilst in exile, you were skating on thin ice, driven by a passion, dancing out your life.
Thank you very much to Tim Burrows, and we shall have more poetry in the weeks to come. Here in the studio, live, we have Jeff Sparks, wearing a t-shirt that says, Home of Metal. Why so? All will become clear. Jeff, hello.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 15th of July, Dogface Sockets will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. Also on 15th of July, Judas Priest will be starting the UK leg of the Epitaph World Tour with support from Queenswyche and also Rival Sons at Newport Centre, which is at 1 Kingsway, Newport, Wales. Doors open at 6:30pm and tickets are £36 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Judas Priest. This group formed in 1969 in Birmingham, England, and to date have released 16 studio albums. This is from the album Sin After Sin, which was released in 1977, and it's the song Diamonds and Rust. That was Judas Priest with Diamonds and Rust from the album Sin After Sin. For more information, you can check out www.judaspriest.com. Into Saturday, 16th of July, the Ramonas, who are an all-girl tribute to the Ramones, will be performing with support from Nobody's Heroes at the Victoria in 88 Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £6 in advance. Finally, at Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery in Chamberlain Square, there is a major exhibition titled Home of Metal, which celebrates over 40 years of heavy metal and its birthplace. The exhibition is on until 25th of September. The entry is £6 for adults, £4 for concessions, and a family ticket is £14. For more information, you can check out www.bmag.org.uk. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM on 93.2 every Sunday. It's also broadcast from Preston on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam.
If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every week when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thank you to our studio guests, Janine Woodward and Bob Nichols. Studio production this week was by Michael Noyes, and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. And you can also find that on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk.
That was Dialect.
I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Colman. Wishing you a very good week. From all the team in Queen Square Studio in Bristol City Centre, thank you for listening. Take care. Goodbye.
To me. War.